Массовый исход из «Единой России» зафиксирован в Красноярском крае.
Еще раз показывает о том, что партия в кризисе, что партия «Единой России».
Министр обороны Анатолий Сердюков сегодня вновь приходил на допрос в Следственный комитет.
В прошлого года нескольких высокопоставленных чиновников холдинга и Минобороны подозревают в мошенничестве.
Молодцы, хорошо работают.
Вакантный мандат депутата Госдумы Рамзана Абдулатипова.
Nobody has been safe. The government, the prime minister, the defense ministry, the state Duma, and the ruling United Russia party have all been subject to withering attacks in recent months. And the opposition didn't even need to lift a finger. Most of the attacks came from within the regime itself. It's been a circular firing squad, and it's been eroding the legitimacy of Russia's key public institutions. Or put another way, it has degraded the building blocks of Vladimir Putin's power vertical. The integrated hierarchical structure he has relied on to buttress his authoritarian rule for more than a decade. The cause of this phenomenon is clear, an ongoing settling of scores and redrawing of spheres of influence in the upper echelons of the Russian elite. But if clan warfare in the deep state is the cause of the current malaise, its effect is a creeping legitimacy crisis that risks undermining the foundations of the authoritarian system Putin built. Is the Russian elite doing the opposition's job for it? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague, live and in person without the aid of a Skype line, is NYU professor Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Good to see you in person, Mark.
Great to be here in the flesh.
Mark, I trace this trend we're witnessing back to late last year and the corruption scandal that cost Anatoly Sertikov his job as defense minister. It continued with a spate of resignations from the Duma and the Federation Council. It seemed to reach its peak, at least for now, with a report last week from a think tank associated with Putin crony Vladimir Yakunin claiming that the December 2011 Duma elections were falsified. In between, we've had a deluge of attacks on Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev and his allies, the government as a whole. I see two things largely driving this. On one hand, the Siloviki faction of the elite is trying to get revenge on the technocrats, on those who wanted to keep Medvedev in the Kremlin. And at the same time, they're trying to reverse the tepid thaw that Medvedev ushered in as president. Secondly, within the Siloviki faction, there's a jockeying for position among its many micro-clans. So, A, is there anything you'd add to that? And B, how long could this go on before it spins out of control?
Well, I would certainly agree that this is being driven by the Siloviki and their sort of campaign to settle old scores and reestablish their position. But in some ways, I'd actually want to pull it further back. I mean, it's not that they just suddenly one day decided, I'll tell you what, let's go after our enemies. The reason they're doing this is really the weakness of Putin. I think we have to put it into that kind of a context. Putin has started several processes rolling. Putin has started a process which is more or less saying, well, okay, what is the future strategy going to be? Because we've had a year of drift. Secondly, it's a process of, well, given that there is going to be some kind of realignment, that means there are opportunities to rise and opportunities to make sure other people fall. And the third element, which is the one element that sort of Putin hasn't deliberately introduced into the process that we've talked about, is the succession issue, precisely because of his weakness, precisely because of the turmoil. So I think in that context, it's not so much that the Siloviki are driving this. I think it's just that the Siloviki are the most powerful and aggressive prosecutors of these various conflicts that have been triggered.
Is there a chicken and egg thing here, though? Is Putin weak because of this clan, these clan battles, or are these clan battles happening because Putin is weak?
It's certainly a vicious circle. I mean, I think I really do believe that it started because Putin had no idea what to do after the unprecedented political environment that followed from the sort of the announcement of the castling and the rise of the middle class protests. If Putin had immediately mastered the situation and, you know, whether right or wrong, but shown he'd had a plan, he probably would have not created this window of opportunity. However, once it started, then the more that the elite begin to conflict amongst themselves, then the weaker Putin becomes and the more the pressure for conflict and so forth. So I think I certainly agree that now we're in that kind of a circular process.
Now, in addition to the Siloviki kind of getting their own back here against the technocrats, there's a process of, within the Siloviki, battles within that clan. Can you speak a little bit of that? Because that's a separate but related process.
Yeah, and I think it says something again about, first of all, that the dangers of using terms like the Siloviki, I mean, which we do because we need to have something to sort of create a handle, but I think, you know, we always need to remember that this is something to unpick. There's a variety of different individuals, there's a variety of different interests. And I think we're beginning to see, I would suggest, two particular processes at work. One is clan or sub-clan versus sub-clan within the Siloviki. You know, we have to talk about Bastrykin at some point, because where would I be without talking about Bastrykin?
Where would any of us be without Bastrykin?
God bless him. You know, but sort of we see the military-industrial complex, we see the security apparatus and so forth. So there's definitely those, shall we say, lateral conflicts. But there's also an underlying meta-theme, which is Sechin's game. Sechin, he is notionally a Silovik, certainly by inclination and by background, but now essentially he is just, you know, a big...
An oil man.
Exactly, an oil rent sort of accumulator. Now, at the moment, he seems to be seeking to not just align himself, but actually meddle with the Silovik faction. Part of me wonders if he's trying to effectively create an alliance within the Silovik movement that is dominated by him. Because if he can do that, then he can actually probably shape the rest of the body politic. But again, I think, although this makes it more and more confusing, there's two struggles going on, the internecine Silovik versus Silovik wars, and Sechin clearly trying to favour some and pit others against others.
Now, Sechin has clearly forged an alliance with Ivanov, and Ivanov seems to be angling to be the successor. He lost out in 08. And a lot of, if I can believe what I read on Live Journal, which is not always, you know, it's, in this case, I think it's accurate. Ivanov is trying to, A, get Medvedev removed, get himself appointed prime minister. His ally in this is Sechin. They've put out a series of very slickly produced movies under the rubric Politmovies on Live Journal and on YouTube and on Facebook. So the Sechin's playing his own game there. He wants Medvedev out because of his feud with Dvorkovich for control of the energy sector. What do you make of how powerful is an Ivanov-Sechin?
It's interesting because, I mean, Ivanov is probably the most ambitious figure within Putin's court, and in part as a result is probably also the most mistrusted and disliked figure within Putin's court. It's hard to think of anyone who is an ally of Ivanov's on personal grounds. They might have particular short-term factional reasons to want to use him or to side with him, but no one trusts him. Because it's just too nakedly obvious what he wants, and the fact that, you know, he's just generally regarded as an untrustworthy individual. If we think of central to Putin's rise was his ability to appear the honest broker. I don't think anyone would ever apply the word honest to Ivanov's sort of manipulations and machinations. So I find it quite surprising to think that anyone would actually build a strategy around the notion of Ivanov reaching the presidency. But that said, given that what Sechin gives today, he can easily take away tomorrow, I imagine that Ivanov is a wonderful fire-and-forget weapon that you can launch at enemies. I mean, I think that exactly Sechin wants Dvorkovich gone or seriously cut down to size, but probably gone. Probably has no time for Medvedev and would also like to see him gone. And in that respect, well, why not use Ivanov as your kamikaze weapon? Ivanov can bring down Medvedev. I'm sure there's some sort of rival compromat or just anyway, but others probably wouldn't want to work with Ivanov. And then a third figure can then come into the scene as the new prime minister.
So Sechin would be hoping that Ivanov would lose in his end game there. It's a bit risky, though.
Well, I'm not sure if it is, in the sense of, I think it's very hard to think of any kind of real coalition building around Ivanov. And also, to be perfectly honest, Ivanov is one of the few people in the sort of the current inner circle scary enough to actually worry Sechin. Ivanov plus prime ministerial, let alone presidential power, actually would be a formidable force, and actually would also be the sort of person who not only could take Sechin on, but might well think it's a good way. I mean, let's face it, if Ivanov could also extend his own personal control through a proxy over the energy sector, then he's unbeatable.
Right. Now, going back to the degradation of the formal state institutions, how far can this continue? Because Putin's rule was based on a lot of things at a lot of levels, right? Within the elite, he was the honest broker and he was the guarantor that they would be able to continue to collect rents. With the public, he was, you know, the one that provided stability and prosperity. But all of this rested on formal institutions at least appearing to be functioning properly. Mm-hmm. And as a result of all this fighting within the deep state, these institutions are being degraded continuously. How much longer can this go on? Where are we if we get to the point where these things become hollow shells?
That's a really good question, and like many good questions, really hard to answer. Mm. In some ways, you only really know it when you reach that point. Right. And what tends to happen, I think, is the institutions become hollowed out and hollowed out and hollowed out to the point that they're just these sort of paper-thin carapaces. And then they can survive as such for a while, but it's then when some external pressure comes along, it pokes its way through and the whole sort of emptiness becomes visible. So it's a very difficult one to answer. But I think I would just make one point about this business of the degradation of the institutions, is that at the moment it is not actually affecting the state's ability to govern. Mm. There's all these kind of rivalries. There's this kind of bizarre new meme of political attack by video emerging. And yes, it's great for people like us who are fascinated in this kind of detail.
Hacking each other's Twitter feeds.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not as though Dvorkovich's ability to actually sort of do his job was affected by happened on his Twitter feed and so forth. So at the moment, the conflict is maintained within the purely political sphere, not the administrative one. Now, for me, I think the big issue is actually when it laps out and affects the state's ability to manage. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I think it was very a wise move to bring Shoigu into the defense ministry, because after you rip out the minister and quite a few sort of his underlings, it could easily have been a situation in which the defense ministry was paralyzed. Shoigu was able to do that. But nonetheless, you can't always rely on that. If, for example, Medvedev does go, and I think he's probably going to be around for a while until this, he's going to go sooner or later, then that's an issue. But let's say, if for example, Dvorkovich has to go, it's hard to see who is immediately ready and willing to actually fill that position.
Right.
So I think we're inching closer to the point when what is just at the moment a purely political struggle actually does begin to affect governance.
And then it becomes existential.
Then it becomes very serious, and then it also then starts falling, cascading down to local levels as well, if Moscow isn't able to exercise control.
Now, I made the analogy in the blog this week to the late Yeltsin period. It was an exaggeration on purpose for effect. But there is something to this. I mean, Putin came to power and public trust was at its nadir. I mean, you had public institutions were just simply not trusted. We had passed this point that you had just alluded to. And we see now Putin's one of his great accomplishments was restoring public trust, restoring public institutions, at least externally. We've kind of come full circle to that again. And this thing seems to repeat itself again and again and again in Russia. Why is that?
Well, it's because power continues to be maintained by deep states in one form or another. No one ever wants to expose themselves to the risk of public rejection in a bid to legitimate themselves. I mean, I think I'd throw two additional points in. I mean, I think the parallel with late Brezhnev, exactly, we're not there at the moment or anything
late
like that.
Yeltsin.
Late Yeltsin, rather. There's a Freudian step. is a compelling one. But I mean, I think one of the differences is that Yeltsin had reached a stage where he couldn't govern.
Right.
In a way, Putin, the tragedy is it is at a point where he won't govern. Mm. But what that means is somehow, whatever change happens, there has to be a Putin-shaped space. Mm-hmm. Yeltsin, you could just replace, and he toddled off to alcoholic retirement and died in due course. But, you know, he had a marginal impact on the body politic once he was out of the presidency.
The stock market went up after he resigned.
Well, quite. Whereas Putin, you know, unless we're going to go for some particularly sort of dramatic scenario that has him, you know, confined to his dacha or whatever, but basically Putin will remain a serious player. Whatever happens. So, I mean, I think there's the whole question of sort of what happens to the Russian government and what happens to Putin.
Yeah.
And the second point I'd make, though, is that the underlying state or condition of the state in the late Yeltsin era was that it was in chaos. There wasn't money, there weren't institutions and so forth. Now, actually, Russia today is in a far, far stronger situation. And on one level, gives it a great deal of resilience. But on the other hand, again, it really emphasizes, I think, the extent to which you really have to work quite hard to so thoroughly delegitimize yourself when actually your economy isn't in a bad shape, mm-hmm. When you face no external military or serious security threats. You know, on a whole variety of indices, Russia's not doing at all badly.
But just one little external crisis could, as you said, burst all of that, pierce all of that. I mean, a sharp drop in oil prices, for example, could a serious economic crisis could seriously another wave of protests of the scale we saw back at the end of 2011 and the beginning of 2012, when the regime was pretty strong and confident still. If you started to see things along those lines, then you could be in for some serious upheaval.
Oh, certainly, I think this is it, and this I think emphasizes the fragile state of the political elite. That precisely they're not in a position to cope with some major shock or like a disaster at Sochi,
mm-hmm. Which is not out of the question.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, so this whole right. I mean, you know, we have no idea what the wild card will be. But one thing we do know from life is that at some point there will be a wild card.
Right. Now, before we move on, there's one other thing I wanted to touch on, is that this degradation of public institutions hasn't really touched Putin yet. Personally, his numbers are holding up okay right now. How much longer before it does begin to affect Putin personally? The institution, the most important institution in the system.
Now, you're killing me, Brian. Keep wanting me to give you these nice, neat time frames.
No.
No, seriously.
Not exactly how long.
Yeah, I think the thing about Putin is because he has created this notion of himself as in some ways the Tsar above the boyars, and that somehow he has nothing particularly to do with the fact that the boyars are squabbling. And, you know, most ordinary Russians, they don't follow the politics sort of at this kind of detail. They don't care. But again, I think I'd want to emphasize the fragility of the situation. At the moment, it's fine because basically, well, Putin is still there and there is no credible alternative to him. And again, I think, you know, these numbers in part reflect the fact that we're not actually seeing a situation where there is anyone really calling Putin to book for what he's doing. But the flip side of that personalization of politics is that, you know, he can't always claim that it's some foolish minister to blame when something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. And if, as I think seems likely, these internal wranglings within the elite start to affect governance, they start to actually degrade the Russian government's ability to do Russian government, well, then that inevitably is going to hit Putin. I mean, again, on a pure gut level, I think that if by the end of this year, for example, there hasn't been some kind of resolution, some kind of turnaround, then I think that's the point where, you know, by that point, people will, I think, have started to think, well, no, this cannot, we cannot reconcile Putin the Great with the squabbling boyars and not realize that actually the two are one and the same.
The emperor has no clothes. Yeah. All right. Well, in a few minutes, we'll continue our discussion and to try to dissect just what happened with that report claiming that the elections in December 2011 were falsified. Why did it come out? And why did Yakunin distance himself from it so quickly? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me in this studio is NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russia security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows, who is performing without the aid of a Skype line. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Единая Россия проиграла прошлые думские выборы коммунистам. Такой неожиданный
доклад. Официальные результаты выборов недостоверные. Единая Россия не заняла первое место.
Сам Владимир Якунин пока никак не комментирует этот доклад в РЖД.
Что за таинственный центр проблемного анализа? Знаете ли вы авторов доклада?
Это такая серьезная экспертная организация подтвердила нашу позицию.
So, let's see if we can get this straight. A report is issued by a think tank associated with Vladimir Yakunin, a Putin crony, a powerful head of Russian railways, a member of the Politburo, a ranking member of the deep state, and this report claims that the Duma elections were falsified, like the opposition has been saying all along. It comes out amid leaks from the Kremlin that they are considering the option of holding early Duma elections, one of the key demands of the opposition in the aftermath of the 2011 elections. Yakunin's a heavyweight. This had to be taken seriously, and it naturally created a buzz. A couple days later, Yakunin comes out and disavows the report, harshly criticizes its author, and says he had nothing to do with it. What was this? Was it a trial balloon? Was the think tank going rogue? Was Yakunin going rogue? And then he had second thoughts. What the hell is going on here?
I love this story, I must say. I think in many ways it exemplifies so many of the things currently happening within Russian politics. The thought of Yakunin going rogue is not one that I'm willing to entertain.
No, neither am I. I was being facetious.
Exactly. This is not a maverick by any standards. But on the other hand, what I do believe is, and I think we pick this up on a whole variety of other situations, it's that the way that politics runs within Putin's inner circle is very rarely explicit. It's very rarely that Putin will actually turn to one of his hench people and say, I want you to do this. It's much more...
will rid me of this troublesome priest.
Precisely. I mean, you know, quite possibly that was behind the Litvinenko killing. So that's another matter. But certainly in this case, I can't help feel that sort of there was an understanding and Yakunin went out and did what he felt Putin wanted. And probably in the detail, something went wrong. Mm. Or just simply it's always handy to have that degree of deniability. Because, I mean, I think what we're seeing is, again, this desperate attempt to try and find some basis for re-legitimizing Putin. Originally, there had been this thought last year about rebranding him Putin the wise, right. Putin the sort of the softer, cuddlier figure. And that, well, we know exactly.
We had a fun podcast about it, though.
Oh, of course. But if you're not going to have Putin the cuddling, the only sort of other key way of legitimizing himself is Putin the not as bad as all the rest. So there is an extent to actually hyping up the communists really makes this much more of a seriously, do you want Putin or do you want Zyuganov?
Right.
Given that Zyuganov is phenomenally unattractive in, and I was talking in political senses, but I'm not,
in every
but
sense.
I think, yes, I'd be willing to see it broadened out. You know, dinosaurian, but also has so clearly compromised. You know, he is the notional chief of the opposition who has clearly shown no real desire to actually take power. He's very happy being the tame oppositionist. So, I mean, in that context, he's, I would say, entirely unviable. And anyway, there's no way that you would get a majority of Russians voting for the Communist Party. Certainly
for Zyuganov.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I can't help but wonder if part of the subtext here was to float the idea that, oh, actually, no, the communists are more dangerous than you thought, which is a way of simply saying, so think about it. You know, suddenly Putin doesn't look as bad compared with that lot.
So kind of be careful what you wish for, because this is the Duma. Yeah. You would have got a communist-run Duma. Another interesting thing in that report that didn't get really, it wasn't the top line in all the stories, but it kind of jumped out at me, was that it said the presidential elections were legit. Putin won with 52%. 52%. Mm. So they, and some ambitious officials just kind of bumped it up, you know, what was his final total? It was in the 60s somewhere. Mm. If that's accurate, and if this report, or whether it's accurate or not, if this report was sanctioned by the Kremlin and came out that Putin only got 52%, again, 52% is fine if you're Barack Obama. In fact, it's a fairly, you know, respectable margin of victory. If you want to be the president in a working democracy where your power is limited by institutions and democratic practices, that's normal. but for the supreme national leader and, you know, father of the nation and so on and so forth, that isn't enough. So on one hand, I mean, and do you think that number does that's, I mean, because I think that's about what Putin got.
Yeah, I find that credible. Yes.
Why would the Kremlin put that out?
Again, I think there's a danger of assuming
the that
they micromanage to the same degree. I mean, I suspect that the point of this report was primarily
the Duma
and the Communist Party, and the 52%, which, again, if you're not a particularly thoughtful individual, you might well think, well, that's fine. It showed that we had a majority. It showed, right, showed that we won. But considering that election wasn't really an election, it was a plebiscite on Putin,
right,
with no meaningful opposition.
That
in that respect, actually, yes, 52% is a very worrying figure for the Kremlin. And who knows quite what it would have been if there had been some even just halfway credible figure standing against him.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's face it, it's 52% of the people who voted.
Right.
And what we do know is a lot of people didn't bother voting because there's that sense of, well, look, you know, I can vote for the communists who seem to be the best bet for actually unseating Putin, but I don't want a communist. Therefore, I just won't bother voting.
Right.
Again, if there had been someone sort of sensible and interesting, then you may well have had a lot more people coming out of the woodwork.
So if you had Putin and Prokhorov head-to-head or something like that.
Yeah. And that would have been an interesting case, because not only in terms of Prokhorov's personal characteristics and what he stands for, because he's not a, you know, he's not an Udaltsov or whatever.
Right.
But also, you know, Prokhorov would have the financial resources to go head-to-head with the administrative resources.
So they just basically screwed up with this. This wasn't a trial balloon. It was basically an attempt to rebrand Putin. Is that how you would interpret it? And it went bad?
I think so. I mean, there is a danger in seeing them as being, you know, morons, obviously, but there's also a danger in seeing them as being too clever. I would be surprised if people really thought much about that 52% figure and what it implied. I don't think that was the focus, because certainly that wasn't really what the discussion was about.
Right. Now, another interpretation I saw of this was that there's clans in the Kremlin fighting over what to do, of course. But there is a group in the Kremlin that's very kind of active right now that is trying to push for early Duma elections, and that this reflected not the will of the Kremlin. The Kremlin has many towers,
mm-hmm.
but one of the towers of the Kremlin pushing for early Duma elections. Now, not everybody's on board with this, and they were trying to create some momentum for this idea. How viable do you think, I mean, how smart a strategy would that be to go for early Duma elections if that was, because this report came out amidst a lot of chatter about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, first of all, the constitutionalists of dissolving the Duma, it's not easy. I don't know how they were going to swing that. But I guess they can do whatever they want at the end of the day and find their pretext afterwards. Assuming they could find the constitutional mechanism to dissolve the Duma or get the Duma to dissolve itself, what would that have helped their cause, or would that have been dangerous?
Honestly, I think it would be dangerous, but that doesn't mean to say that I don't think they'll do it. I mean, I think it's absolutely essential that if they do decide to do this, then it has to be as legal looking as possible. And that means probably will be that the Duma will dissolve itself.
Mm.
And it might well be in tandem with either refashioning or more like the replacement of United Russia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's the key thing. I mean, just having a Duma election is meaningless,
yeah.
Not just because the Duma is meaningless, but also because it would just be a sort of a slight reshuffling or whatever. I mean, one could go for the real conspiracy theory and say he wants to have an anti-government majority so that he can then sort of...
Yeah, Menshikov floated that possibility.
Yeah, that for me is getting too cute.
Mm-hmm.
If Surkov had been around, who knows?
It's not too cute for Surkov.
Exactly, but I think for the current establishment it is. But nonetheless, let's say that actually what they're thinking is, look, you know, we are stuck with this United Russia, you know, which Navalny has already rebranded as a collection of thugs and criminals. And so we need to move beyond that. And maybe there's a sense of, well, we'll have a, you know, sweep, new election, some new kind of electoral bloc, quite possibly a new prime minister, make that... activity.
Well, the popular front was going to be...
Yeah,
was going to be...
But as a surrogate for anything, any new policies or anything, just a lot of activity makes it look like we're doing different stuff.
Let society let off steam, and it also could provide a pretext to dismiss the government.
Hmm.
since Medvedev is the head of United Russia, right? So, but it's also quite dangerous in this environment. I mean, you have a restive public, and you know, if you really want to control these elections, well, you got to falsify them, and that's what got you in trouble to begin with.
Right? But I think again, what it reflects is precisely that they know something needs to be done. And let's be honest, that actually, you know, what really needs to happen is a re-legitimation of the state, which will involve reaching out and finding some common cause and giving some reason for the sort of, you know, whole variety of different groups within Russian society to actually believe in the state again. That would almost certainly involve clamping down on the elite, clamping down on corruption, etc. Mm. Given that Putin does not have the will or the stomach to do that, and possibly even the ability to do that, instead, he's having to resort to pokazuka, you know, to the appearance of activity, which is, yes, dangerous, because at some point people will notice what you're doing.
Right. We're probably going to see a lot more of this kind of thing in the weeks to come. It's just amazing how these things pop up and then they're like down the memory hole. I mean, this was the talk of Moscow when it popped out, and now it's been disavowed and everybody's kind of forgotten about it. Like, okay, never mind. So I imagine we're going to see a bit more of this before they figure out just exactly what it is they want to do. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me in the studio has been NYU professor Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, Mark. Great to see you.
Likewise. Good to be here.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, author of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and most certainly should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.